call the Committee of Environmental, Conference Committee on Environmental Natural Resources, House and Senate Conference Committee to order April 20, 2017. We're approximately half an hour after the session closed over in the Senate. And so we're going to start out today, and all we're going to do today, members, just so you know, is public testimony. I think you have a schedule of the folks at the agenda, and we're going to be specific to the people who are going to be testifying and going to be specific to a certain part of the bill. Folks, because we've heard testimony several times, and in fact you're going to see actually doubling up on some of the amendments here, so we're going to work as quickly as we can. We're going to start out with the commissioners. They each have 10 minutes, and the testifiers after that will have 20 minutes. Excuse me, 2 minutes. Wow, that was a good one. And after that, members, then we'll ask, open it up for questions if it works out. So, Mr. Chair, are you okay with that?
Yeah, just
perfect.
Point of order, Tory Westrom's not here. No.
Point of order, Tory Westrom's not here. Some things we just get used to around here, I guess. So first off, Senator Landwehr. Excuse me. Commissioner Landwehr.
Motion.
Yeah, now we have a quorum. If you're a senator, we're good. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and appreciate your time. There are a couple documents moving around, Mr. Chair, members. One is, that's enough. I got my hearing aids in. I don't know if it's on.
New definition to big documents, Commissioner. Wow, that's a good one.
Remember, this guy sells trees.
More paper from the mill in the National Falls.
All right.
Is that better? Is that
what everybody got one?
Mr. Chair, members, so two documents. Is that loud enough? Is that?
Oh, that's better, yep.
One, Mr. Chair, is the letter, and the other is a large spreadsheet. We'll refer to that in a moment.
I think the letter might be in our packet. We have that right.
And again, because I sell trees, there are many pages.
Yep.
From Boise. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the time today, and I'm just going to, you all have a copy of the letter. I'm going to hit some of the high points in it, leave some time for questions if there are any. A couple months ago, we presented the department's budget, the governor's budget request. Really, as I mentioned at the time, that was primarily to just keep our programs going at the level they were at. We were not proposing to do a lot of new stuff. It was essentially to keep doing what we're doing. We think in the three areas of responsibility of our mission, outdoor recreation, preserving natural resources, and providing economic development, we're at a pretty good spot. And so we're really looking primarily at dealing with inflation over the next 2 years and a little bit with some of the growing demand we've got. But Mr. Chair, members, as I also mentioned, 85% of our budget is fee-derived, and so it is hunting and fishing license fees, it's ATV fees, it's water appropriation fees, and so since those are all statutory, we also have to come to you periodically to get increases on those, and I'll talk about some of the fund balances in each of those in a moment. Mr. Chair, members, I guess in short, I'd like to assert that since most of these fees are user-generated for specific activities, most of those users have expressed support because they see the actions, they see the outcomes of the work that we do. And so the good news for us and hopefully for you when you have to make a hard decision is that the users support these fee increases because they see the benefit that these fee increases will provide. Mr. Chair, members, going to the second page, there is a table there that is a subset of this larger spreadsheet. And what I'd like to emphasize is that in the governor's budget, there were a number of fee increases that are not reflected for the most part in the Senate and the House bills. And this chart shows what happens to those fund balances. As you know, we have statutory funds. Revenues are generated from specific users or benefited parties. They go into that fund, and that fund is there to fund the activities coming out of there. We maintain a balance in those funds because we generate more money than we spend in some years. We spend more money than we generate in others. And as you can see in this sheet, on almost all of these funds, we will project to go negative. In other words, the spending would exceed the fund balance in virtually every one of these funds. Some of these funds have not been increased. The fees going into these funds have not been increased for 10 years or more. And we can't go into the red. We cannot deficit spend, as you know, in any of these funds. And so what happens is the year before we would go into the red, we will have to start making reductions. I'll use the game and fish operations as an example, Mr. Chair, members. That's in the top left on the front page. Right now, we would be projecting to go into the red in fiscal 2020. That's in your letter. Under the governor's proposed budget, we would stay in the black through fiscal 19. So in that top left square where the numbers are, with the governor's proposal, we would stay in the black through fiscal 21. Without the adjustments, as you can see on that first line, we would project to go into the negative in fiscal 20. The same format in all of those cells there. In the House, with the House proposal, we will be in the negative in fiscal 20. With the Senate, we'll be in the negative in fiscal 20. Heritage Enhancement, Peace Officer Training Fund, all of these accounts on the left column demonstrate the challenges we're going to be facing over the next few years. We will be negative in virtually all of these within a couple of years. Some of them were already in the negative. If you look at the snowmobile, ATV, water, rec accounts, we're already in the negative on some of those accounts. And so without additional revenues, we simply have to reduce services. And in the case of water rec, the state maintains 1,500 public water accesses. Those require annual maintenance. Many of them have a dock on them now, and if we don't get the docks out in time, we hear right away that I couldn't get my boat in because you don't have a dock there. We have to replace the concrete pads quite periodically. That water rec account funds that. In the case of ATV snowmobiles, much of that money is pass-through grant and aid dollars to local clubs to take care of facilities. We are reducing those grants already. In the case of game and fish, and this is a big one for us, we will be reducing the effort that we can put out for promoting hunting, by managing habitat, for promoting fishing, by managing lakes, and that simply is a step backwards from where we really need to be. And so you can see all of these other fee-based programs, Mr. Chair and members, and as I mentioned, neither of the House or Senate bills adjust those, and so right now we're looking at some fairly significant reductions in those fund balances and in the services we provide there. Mr. Chair, members, looking at the second page of the letter going to the Parks and Trails Fund, the Senate does provide $1 million per year for Parks and Trails, but that doesn't even meet the $3.45 million one-time funding that we got last fiscal year. So we start in the negative by almost $2.5 million right at the beginning, not even considering some of the known inflationary increases we're going forward. When I say known inflationary increases, we know, for instance, that the employee contracts have increases built into them that are known inflation that we have to deal with, not even accounting for inflation we might see in some of the other supplies we purchase and so on. We appreciate that the House budget does increase the fees and funding for state parks. It does not, unfortunately, also address some of the needs that we have in trails. And so much of our maintenance activities for trails comes out of the general fund and some of the other and some of the dedicated funds, but primarily general fund. We don't have adequate funding right now to take care of the trails that we've got. We are working very diligently. We've got some very dedicated staff doing what they can to stretch the life of those trails out. But we simply are getting more trails created than we are able to maintain. And so without some additional funding there, those trail situations will get worse. I mentioned fish and wildlife. One point I would make, again, with fish and wildlife that is true across the department is this what we call operating adjustment. And that's just to deal with, the known inflationary pressures we're going to feel, primarily with employee contracts, but also for things like health care and some of the pension adjustments that may be coming as well. Mr. Chair, members, enforcement, bottom of page 3. We currently have 17 vacancies in the Division of Enforcement in our field force. The governor's proposal would have addressed those vacancies
and provided some opportunity for increasing the workforce. Under both the House and the Senate versions, there is enough, there's a little bit of money that may cover some of the inflation, but it does not do anything to address the current vacancies in the field force. So as we sit right now, just the known inflation will prohibit us doing anything with those vacancies that we've got already. If some of the employer pension changes are made that are proposed in House File 1288, we could see some additional budgetary pressures that could result in an additional 10 vacancies. Mr. Chair, members, in forestry, on page 4, the middle of page 4, both the House and the Senate addressed much of the governor's request for forestry funding, including some of the reforestation dollars we need. But again, the operating adjustments have not been considered, and so the net impact is not the result that I think both the House and the Senate were hoping for by putting those dollars in, because we still have to deal with the inflationary request. So the lack of an operating adjustment will affect 18 positions within the forestry program, resulting in fewer cords of wood being put up. There's some proposed appropriations from the Forest Management Investment Account that, while they are sustainable within the account right now, they would drive the balance down so far that we are uncomfortable with a $700,000 balance in a market that is very, very volatile and could constrain our ability for working cash flow if we should get into a down market. Mr. Chair, members, I think everybody knows, on the committee knows about the proposal by Louisiana Pacific to expand in northeastern Minnesota. There is considerable concern right now in the forest products industry that additional demand for 800,000 cords of wood could drive the prices up statewide if we cannot produce additional timber to meet that demand. And so every boot on the ground that we can get is essential to get that timber put up. We're undergoing a sustainability analysis right now to see if the state can put an additional 2 million cords or 200,000 cords on the market. But again, even that leaves us 600,000 cords short from what the potential demand is. So this is one of those areas where the foundation of northern Minnesota is based on tourism, taconite, and timber. We really need to ensure that we get funding for this program to make sure that Louisiana Pacific finds its competitive place to work.
Mr. Hushman, please, out of respect for everybody else, we'll have to wrap it up.
Mr. Chair, members, the last thing I would mention is with respect to ecological and water resources. The funding proposals in both the House and the Senate did not address the aquatic invasive species account, nor some of the water protection accounts. And Mr. Chair, members, I recognize that there has been additional funding provided to the counties. If it's a discussion of the legislature, the state reduce our effort so that it can complement the counties, we will change the strategy in how we provide those services. But Mr. Chair, members, absent the requests we put forward, we won't be able to continue the level we provided.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we do have the policies concerns in here. And if members have any questions at the end, we'll have them up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Next is Commissioner Lingstein. I understand he's not here, so Ms. Gauthier. And the MPCA. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I apologize that Commissioner Stein could not be here. He is chairing a national call of his counterparts from the 50 states right now, and could not get away from that until about 4 o'clock. Mr. Chairman, we also sent a letter to the committee today, and I believe copies were passed out, so it's dated yesterday, April 19th. I'm just going to hit the highlights. A lot of the details aren't in our letter, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to thank the committees for some language that we supported that is in the bill, including the House includes our business-friendly data services initiative to put data and our permitting services online faster for $800,000 over the biennium. The House side also provided funding for PolyMet legal services, which are critical so that we can establish a legal record, which the agencies will need regardless of which way the PolyMet permit goes. Both sides included our policy measure to extend the ban on the construction of new open-air swine pits, and the Senate included the governor's 25 by 25 a new initiative which will be led by the Environmental Quality Board. So we do appreciate the inclusion of all those. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak to the budget problems first. There are five major budget problems in this bill. First one is that it fails to fund our operational adjustments for inflation, forcing us to absorb nearly $7 million over the biennium and eliminating up to 70 employees. The second is that it shifts many new responsibilities to the Environmental Fund. It's to the tune of about $5.8 million over the biennium in the House version, $10.2 million over the biennium in the Senate. And it does this shift without providing corresponding new resources in the Environmental Fund so that we can carry out these responsibilities. These shifted responsibilities include funding for the EQB, our municipal liaison, our entire feedlot program, the St. Louis River remediation, and, Mr. Chairman, none of these are small things. The rearranging of our budget structure makes changes without any operating advantage at all, yet adds a tremendous amount of uncertainty for the future due to the pressure on the Environmental Fund. The third is new legislation that is also being funded out of the Environmental Fund at a cost of around $9 million per biennium. These include the Chamber of Commerce's permitting bill and some of the bills by the Coalition of the Greater Minnesota Cities. We thank the House for providing $1.15 million to fund these. It's about 16% of the total cost. The Senate does not provide funding, so that is additional pressure on the Environmental Fund. The fourth problem is that the bills both cut $4.356 million from the Environmental Fund. Mr. Chairman, the Environmental Fund is comprised of fees and the solid waste management tax that are paid by fee payers who expect us to do certain services in return for the payment of those fees. And if you divert those funds, as this your bills do, to the general fund, then you are breaking the trust of these fee payers and the trust that their fees will support the intended purposes for which those fees are paid. The fifth problem, Mr. Chairman, is that the cap on the transfers to the remediation fund is far too low at $34 million. This will have serious results for many of our cleanup programs, including Superfund, because those programs will suffer when we have to respond to emergency situations first in order to protect the public health. Because of these five changes, Mr. Chairman, and the cap, including the cap, because of those five, the Environmental Fund, which is the main fund that funds our work, will be in the red in 2020 and every single year after that. There's a couple other budget items that are a problem. The early removal of $4 million from the closed landfill investment fund in the House to work on the freeway landfill in Burnsville. We oppose taking those funds from the closed landfill investment account because that money is supposed to be for the long-term care and maintenance of the 109 closed landfills across the state. It is not intended to go to pay for the cleanup of one landfill where there's a problem owner who won't enter the closed landfill program. We believe this is a terrible precedent. There are several other provisions that act the same as cuts. One of those is a 50% reduction in our base funding in the Senate bill for our water monitoring work. Mr. Chairman, due to the discussion, concern, controversy over supplement versus supplant, we believe this puts our $16.5 million Clean Water Fund appropriation for water monitoring at risk. We also are very concerned about trading $5 million in SCORE grants at the expense of MPCA employees in the House language. We support SCORE, of course, but these are the very employees who would be supporting the counties in the work that they are getting the SCORE grants to do. Also, we are finding that the air quality statutory automatic increase language is not in either bill, and that is required under federal and state law. So there are the major problems we have, and just to put them into context, our budget did come in slightly under the 16-17 level. So our agency did our job. We were responsible. We did make some reductions. And so we are not an agency that is spending more and more and more. We actually propose to spend less this year. Also, Mr. Chairman, an update on the cuts proposed by the Trump administration. They are proposing a 61% reduction in their base grant to states, and Minnesota would be a 61% reduction for our core services of permitting and enforcement, et cetera. They are also proposing a 100% elimination of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which would dramatically impact our efforts to clean up the St. Louis River estuary and to get two-thirds match from the federal government for that work. Together, all of these...
Ms. Coffey, excuse me, do you have a document that says that?
Not
for,
on
for the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be able to get that for you, yes.
Please, thanks.
Thank you. On the policy side, Mr. Chairman, our letter outlines numerous concerns. In the interest of time, I won't go through them all except to say that we feel the policy changes are taking away some very important clean water tools that we have in our water quality standards, which are suspended for 2 years, all the water quality standards since 2014. Mr. Chairman, we did some research, and that would mean that at least 90 cities in Minnesota would not be able to get renewals on their wastewater treatment plant permits. That will impact their efforts to borrow money or to get money from the Public Facilities Authority, and I don't know what all the other impacts they may have, but that will happen. Also, we're very concerned about the language delaying the impaired waters list. By allowing it to be challenged when it's still in a draft form, it could put us in an endless loop of constantly going around and around and never finishing that data, which is very important to federal, state, and local entities as well as community groups that need to know where our polluted waters are located so that they can clean them up. There's numerous provisions that bog down our rulemaking and slow down our permitting work. And what Commissioner Stein wanted to highlight that we are again grateful that our business-friendly data initiative is in the House bill. It is missing in the Senate bill. And also our initiatives on construction and demolition landfills, where we have 42 of them that are leaking into groundwater across the state. And also our initiative related to the vapor intrusion in homes and businesses from Superfund, Petrofund, and tank sites are missing from both bills. I also need to mention that the state government bill has numerous provisions that will slow down permitting and bog down our rulemaking, and of course the transportation bill has the problematic language that is reducing our motor vehicle title transfer fee revenue by an estimated $27 million per biennium starting in 2020, which will put further pressure on the environmental fund, the main fund that funds our work. Finally, in addition to your bill, the transportation and the jobs bill all have language in them about the Volkswagen settlement. We are still, we've talked to many of you and we presented in committee. I'm not going to go into details except to say that the trustee for those funds is still not able to give us much guidance about what will be needed. The Kentucky legislature passed a bill, Republican-led legislature passed a bill that appropriated those funds. It was vetoed by the Kentucky governor, also a Republican. So I think having language that is going to specifically appropriate those funds is remaining to be a very strong concern of the commissioners, that it may make it difficult or impossible for us to get those funds. So, Mr. Chairman, the rest of the detail is in our letter. In the interest of time, I'll stop there.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank Commissioner Weinstein for the well-detailed letter here. And if we have any questions, we'll certainly get a hold of you. Mr. Jaski. From Pauzer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, John Jaski, Executive Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to highlight a few of our concerns and also point out a couple of things that we do very much support. The first piece of this will be about the budget elements. The largest concern, of course, we have is that the Soil and Water Conservation District funding that was put in place 2 years ago for their operations is being shifted from the general fund to the Clean Water Fund. And the Soil and Water Conservation Districts are locally elected. They work very closely with private landowners on conservation and clean water work. They also have the limitation that they don't have their own mechanism to secure funding. They are reliant entirely on the state or county or grant sources. And so this funding that was put in place 2 years ago was for their base operations. And so this is very important that they have a reliable and ongoing source of funding to do that work. And taking it from the Clean Water Fund just means there's less money to do the actual projects, which the Clean Water Fund was intended to increase and supplement what was already going on. The second point I'll make on the concerns is to the base adjustments that the agency proposed and the governor recommended. Those are not in either bill. Serving a local government clientele is something that our agency is responsible for, and those omissions in the budget are going to, hamper that greatly. As Commissioner Landberg described, there are these inflationary costs that are across all of our agencies that need to be addressed at some point in time, and this bill would be the place to do, in our opinion. We also have a particular mandate in this category that is unfunded currently to oversee the implementation of a performance review and efficiency program that we work on local government performance. That is not also in this bill funded currently. There are a couple of things that are in the bill that we support. Obviously, the provision that allows the agency and the DNR and others to work towards a federal agreement on federal 404 assumption for wetland protection would be something the governor supported, as well as the House position that's in the bill. And both the House and the Senate have the easement stewardship, an initial amount to make sure the investments we've made in the conservation easements are well managed and providing the long-term benefits that they were established for. Let me go into the policy provisions. So there's two categories here that I'll highlight. The first, of course, is the buffer provisions that are in both bills, not exactly the same. Our letter sort of outlines the pieces of each of them that are problematic. Last year the legislature made some changes, and the governor supported this bill that, clarified some of the provisions, and I think, has made it more workable than it was prior. And local governments are working with landowners to get this endeavor accomplished, and we believe that the progress we've made will continue with the policies in place as is, and so that's what we would like to see continue. There is one potential connection in the budgetary fashion to this. The local governments, the counties and watershed districts who would have to do the compliance work, the funding for that had been proposed by the governor to be in the tax bill. It is not there. It is not in this bill. And so if we're going to rely on them to be that local agent to do that work, we're going to need to find a way to help them cover the cost. And so that will be an important consideration, perhaps in some cross communications between the various conference committees. And then finally, on the policy, there are a couple of wetland provisions that we believe are need some attention, having to do primarily with not standards being changed, but the transparency and the proceedings that are important to make sure that landowners and others who are affected by those projects have a chance to review and comment on them. The first one has to do with some permit to mine situations where they're doing off-site mitigation. The second one has to do with the environmental review proceedings, which are intended to be a broad look at projects and the potential impacts, not really to be a site-specific permit that individual landowners could be aware of and participate in if they were being affected by it. And finally, the last one is something that we think is a good idea. We just need to make sure it is intended to be applied the way it was intended, because there's this deed restriction provision which is intended to be a consumer protection measure that in one case, and only one case, was applied as a result of a court proceeding, and it didn't entirely get resolved through the court. So we support the idea of clarifying that by making sure it continues to work for the original purpose that was intended. Mr. Chairman and members, I think I'll stop there, and if you want any more information, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Next up, Mr. Swift. From the EQB, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Will Swift, Executive Director, Environmental Quality Board. We're a little smaller than those agencies before us, so I promise you our list is shorter, and I will not take nearly 10 minutes. Thank you for the opportunity to make some comments on House File 888. I just want to briefly address the following budget and policy provisions. Thank you for including base funding for the EQB in both the House and Senate versions. We prefer the appropriations language in the Senate bill. Neither bill, however, includes the governor's proposed change item for the EQB, which is a small but critically important request for the board. Governor's 18-19 budget proposes the continuation and expansion of an effort to modernize the environmental review program with an emphasis on training and support to local governments. Having an environmental review program that's efficient and effective and meets the needs of Minnesota businesses and citizens requires an ongoing investment. Without this funding, the EQB will be forced to cut two positions and will be unable to continue updates to environmental review rules, enhance data collection, and outreach to local partners. Briefly on a couple of policy provisions, Section 113 of the House file and Section 101 of the Senate file include changes to EQB membership and criteria. This section adds additional requirements for applicants that they have knowledge of and be conversant in environmental review or permitting. This would narrow the field of eligible applicants and refocus the board's citizen membership away from broader environmental issues. We think this experience is valuable, but should not be prohibitive to all other qualified applicants, nor should it come at the expense of other valuable expertise, especially as a criteria for all citizen members. This section also changes the composition of the board. We do not support striking the governor's representative from the board, as this appointment serves as the chair of the board pursuant to Statute 116C03, Subdivision 3A. So we would want to address that as we move forward with these provisions. The changes would also add three additional citizen members, changing the balance of board decisions and discussions, and adding costs to an already lean budget. That said, we do support the effort to ensure greater geographic distribution of EQB membership. We believe these membership changes would benefit from further study and consideration. Briefly, Section 114 of the House bill and the related repealers of 116C04, Subdivisions 3 and 4, are significant changes to the jurisdiction of the board. These provisions are not included in the Senate file. These changes would narrow our jurisdiction dramatically and would curtail all of our interagency work not related to environmental review. The whole premise of our existence is to be a platform for interagency coordination and public involvement. The board strongly opposes these proposed jurisdictional changes. That's all for now, and I'm happy to be around for questions later.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, Mr. Crawley from the Minnesota Zoo. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing from the Minnesota Zoo today. My name is John Crawley, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Zoo, and I'm a new director, just over a year old. So having fun at the Minnesota Zoo, it's been a good year. The zoo's doing great this summer. But I want to give you a little insight. I think you might have seen a couple articles about the Minnesota Zoo this last month to get a little bit of feel for my first year. The first article talked about building a sustainable zoo model that's feasible. And so it's one of our big focuses is to have a feasible model going forward that rebuilds and keeps the zoo a world-class zoo. The second article that you might have read was our commitment to diversity, inclusion, and access at the Minnesota Zoo. You know, my first year at the zoo, I think a lot of people hear about FOMO Zoo being a free zoo, and I love FOMO Zoo. It's one of the first zoos I ever went to as a child. But Minnesota Zoo is a free zoo to those Minnesotans who need it to be free as well. What we've done at Minnesota Zoo has made a commitment, and we've aligned our access with the same programs outlined by the general assistance programs in the state of Minnesota. So when there's somebody that has a WIC card or a SNAP card, all they need to do is show it at our front entrance, and we give them full access. It's a new direction for the zoo, and since we've changed this and headed in this new direction, our attendance from underserved Minnesotans has gone up over 200%. You know, so I think we're on track this year to do over 200,000 Minnesotans for free at the Minnesota Zoo. So I think it's a big, new, bold direction that the zoo is going in, and it's a great asset to Minnesotans. To refresh our case for the zoo, you know, as director of the Minnesota Zoo, on behalf of our members, our staff, and our 1.4 million visitors, I want to encourage the conference committee to adopt the House position with respect to the zoo's general operating fund. I can remind you that the zoo is a unique state agency established in law as a public-private partnership. You know, and basically what that means is one-third of our funding comes from the state general fund. But two-thirds of our funding is my job and our team's job. Two-thirds, we have to be smart business people, and we have to raise that two-thirds of our fund. We do it through earned revenues, retail, foods, admissions, and also with fundraising. As a new director to this job, I love this business model. It's a diversified model, and it's a model that allows us to be a world-class zoo. Some quick background for the zoo, $27 million a year budget, caring for over 5,300 animals, 365 days a year, safety, security for 1.4 million visitors. We have a 485-acre campus. It's like a small city. It's a large zoo. We do education programs for over 445 participants a year. This year, we're on track to do 100,000 kids in field trips, coming from over 1,000 schools in Minnesota. We have critical conservation programs working with the DNR and others on butterflies, bison, mussels. In the past, we worked with loons and swans. Like I said, we're launching a major new program called Zoo Unlimited, focusing fully on access and removing those barriers and getting out to greater Minnesota. And I think the other point I want to make to a lot of people is I don't think you realize the scale of the Minnesota Zoo. We are the fifth largest zoo in the country. Our education programs are well known with all other zoos. Our conservation programs are well known. A little bit of stats. Farm babies this last weekend, last few weekends, we had one day that 14,000 Minnesotans came out on a Saturday for farm babies. We did STEM programming this year, and over 7,000 to 8,000 students were coming every day for our STEM programming. So it's a large scale that we're addressing. This year, and if you do the economic results of that, the zoo produces $146 million in economic impact, over 1,700 jobs, returning $14 for every dollar of state investment. This year, we're asking for a modest increase in our funding needs, obviously to focus on salaries, cost of living, health insurance, pension funds, operating costs, utilities, and, of course, animal food. With this modest increase, I remind you that our team will be working on a two-thirds of that increase and rolling up our sleeves to make sure we match that at the staff. And to end, I just want to say this request and our state support, it's critical. It's critical for our world-class zoo for all Minnesotans and Minnesotans who deserve an experience and a destination like the zoo. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful place to visit. There's no question. If you haven't been there with your kids or grandkids, it's certainly a good place to go and visit and appreciate the work you're doing. So thank you for the report.
Thank you.
Next, Mr. Antonsen, Conservation Corps. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Eric Antonsen with Conservation Corps. First of all, thank you for the base funding that's included in the bill, and I assure you we'll make efficient and impactful use of those funds to restore resources and change lives. I use the words efficient and impactful very intentionally because of the great work that our core members do day in and day out throughout the year. I also use those words because the general funds and natural resource funds in this bill and then the legacy funds in the legacy bill of a different committee represent just 30 cents on the dollar of our budget. The remaining 70 cents we leverage through a social enterprise model in which we partner with federal, state, and local entities and nonprofit organizations. We've also grown our public and private partnerships through individual donations, charitable foundation grants, and corporate support. For example, just the other week, Minnesota Power agreed to provide shop space for our crews in Duluth. In addition to the base funding that's included in this bill, the governor's budget recommendation included an additional $385,000 per year of general funds to engage an additional 320 youth. This funding would continue and expand an effort that we successfully piloted with LCCMR in calendar years 2015 and 16. About 85% of the high school youth supported by these funds would be from demographics typically underrepresented in the natural resource field. That would include women, people of color, individuals with disabilities, and individuals from low-income households. We currently receive about 4 applications for each of those positions, so there's a big need out there. In addition to connecting more youth to the natural resource management field and completing valuable projects in the process with our partners, these funds would improve some of the support that we provide for young people in terms of counseling and things like that while they're in high school, after high school, and while they're in college. These funds would also help us build stronger relationships with underrepresented communities all around Minnesota, and that would include, by way of an example, partnership we're working on with Bemidji State University right now. So as you work on this bill, and if the targets change, our request is respectfully that you would include the additional $385,000 per year so that diverse young people can experience a viable college and career pathway while accomplishing vital natural resource work for our state in the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, members, we're going to go into the testimony of interested parties here. We'll start out with Tom Hackworth, and if you'll note on the on your sheets, we have the pages that we're talking about, and we're going to be specific to that, and each testifier will have about 2 minutes, and again, we'll stick around for questions afterwards. So, Tom, I want to call you Representative Hackworth. I guess I can still do that. We're here to talk about Senate Section 2, House Section 12, R4 and R10. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for helping us work on the legislation that's in this bill. There's a number of provisions that are the same on both sides. But to start out with, I would like also to mention that I represent the All Train Vehicle Association of Minnesota and also ARMCA, the Amateur Motorcycle Riders Association, and there's a number of provisions in the bill that we do support. Also, on the spreadsheet on line 127 and 129, there's some Senate money that we do support. It's not on the House side, but we do support that. I'd just like to bring that up as well. We're looking at Section 12 on R10, and in order to talk about that, we have to talk about Section 11 as well, because Section 12 is a result of Section 11, which is only on the House side, and that was a Representative Eklund bill that was done in the House. And we do support that, and we do support both Section 11 and Section 12 on the House side on page R9 and R10. Mr. Chairman, we also want to discuss a provision that's on the Senate side. It's Section 2. It's only on the Senate side. And it's a great concern to the All-Train Vehicle Association of Minnesota and ARMCA. I think some other motorized groups should be concerned about that as well. This is a commingling of funds for enforcement, taken from the dedicated funds for all the various off-road motorcycles, off-road trucks, off-road ATVs, those kinds of things. And it spells out in these statutes here where they're taking the money from to form this special revenue fund for enforcement. You will notice that if you look at these numbers, snowmobiles are not included. I think if anybody's been talking to the DNR about this fund, we've been talking about taking some of this money and commingling it so that we have some extra enforcement money that, for in the wintertime for snowmobiles. Well, they're not even included in the legislation. I don't know why that is. So you might want to be concerned about that. Also, we're very concerned that if you look at the spreadsheet that we have today at the various accounts, the ATV account, for example, is put in the black through 2019. And if you look at the snowmobile account, they're in the red right now. So we're concerned that co-mingling these funds are not going to be paid back to the individual accounts where they came from. There's no language that says that that's going to happen. So it's robbing Peter to pay Paul and never being paid back. So this legislation needs more work. I would recommend that we take Section 2 out of the bill and we work on this and come back, have the DNR come back with something that's going to work. This does not work. If you look at some of the other funds that are included in this, it's a water wreck account, it's an invasive species account, off-road motorcycles, off-road trucks. Some of these are in the black. And again, they're robbing Peter to pay Paul and they're not paying it back in any way, shape, or form. So we're adamantly opposed to that. We think it's a good concept to maybe borrow some money from some of these funds, if these funds are sitting there, to help out in a time when we need some extra money for enforcement. That's okay. But let's pay it back. We don't want to just steal it and continue to steal it and continue to steal it. That's not the way that that should work. So I think we need to work on this, and I would recommend that we take that from the bill. That's all I have, unless anyone has any questions.
Thank you. We'll hold our questions until call in. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Next up is
Ms. Loomis from the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District. Senate provisions, Drift Minnesota River spread line, sheet 237. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity at the Lower Minnesota River Water. My name is Linda Loomis. I'm the administrator of the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District. And we are requesting state help with our role as the local sponsor for managing the navigation channel on the Minnesota River. In that role, we are responsible for managing the material that is dredged from the river in order to maintain navigation up to the city of Savage. And we feel that it's appropriate to ask the state to assist this. The river basin's 117,000 square miles, drains 19% of the state of Minnesota, and the watershed district is the last 80 miles of that district. So we're basically at the end of the funnel. The amount of dredge material that we're seeing is continuing to increase due to increased precipitation, changing markets, and changing agricultural practices, while the cost of disposing of this material is increasing at the same time. And the management of the flow of water in our watershed basin, most of this problem occurs outside where we have no jurisdiction to regulate or manage the amount of sediment or the flow of water that comes down the district. And, river commodity transportation by river is the cheapest, most efficient mode of transportation compared to trains and trucks and has much less impact on the other transportation infrastructures and on public safety. And Minnesota benefits economically from the sustainability of the commercial navigation on the 9-foot channel. The majority of the agricultural crops grown in the river basin are shipped through the Minnesota River Navigation Channel down to the ports in the Gulf. And I think that might be all I have to say. We appreciate your consideration of funding. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, I think just the last thing we want to say is that a very narrow strip in the bottom 14 miles, is it, from Savage down
32 miles
from Savage down to the mouth of the where the Minnesota comes into the Mississippi, very narrow strip. Their residents alone pay the costs for the maintenance of that channel. Their annual cost projected over the next 15 to 20 years is $480,000 a year. We feel the state's benefit by having this kind of navigational channel and the economic benefits to the state should be responsible for some of that cost. And we appreciate the Senate's appropriation for $240,000, and we think that is a good starting place. If ultimately we do not see some changes in the amount of sediment coming down the river, I would fully expect that the Watershed District would be back asking for additional contribution from the state to address increasing costs associated with sustainability of this navigational channel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you both. Next up, Jeff Hitt from the Minnesota Propane Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Jeff Hutt. I'm representing the Minnesota Propane Association here today, and it's referring to a bill with the Senate committee. Today I'd like to share with you and the members of this committee the benefits of propane as it pertains to our environment and to the safety of it.
This is the school bus section, members. Okay. Go ahead. Thanks.
Propane is a safe, environmentally friendly fuel that is available and used by many people, from homeowners to businesses to schools to farms, you name it, it's everywhere. It is an approved Clean Air Act. It's part of the 1990 Clean Air Act and the Energy Policy Act of 1992. It's non-toxic. It contains no lead, benzene to sulfur, so it doesn't contaminate our soil, our air, or our water. typically you'll see 20% fewer nitrogen oxide emissions, 60% fewer carbon monoxide emissions, 24% fewer greenhouse gas emissions, and fewer particulate emissions as well. It's abundant, it's clean American energy. We have vast reserves of it. In fact, today the United States is a net exporter of propane. And there's also a growing and an existing and growing refueling infrastructure that's very safe and allows you to quickly and easily refuel without any spillage, evaporation, pilferage, or water in your fuel tanks. School buses are embracing this, and many more want to partake of it, but they need the funding from the Volkswagen mitigation settlement to allow them to partake in expanding the clean air that propane power buses will offer. They're also, from a safety perspective, they're 20 times the tanks themselves are 20 times more puncture resistant and can withstand four times the pressure compared to gasoline. There's also built-in safety devices and shutoffs that allow for proper expansion and contraction. And if anything should rupture in terms of a fuel line, they'll shut off automatically. You don't have to push anything or take any action. There's a relatively lower working pressure of between 150 and 250 PSI, which is less than 10% of compressed natural gas, if you compare the two. And it requires a higher temperature to ignite, and the flammability window is actually more narrow than any other alternative energy that's out there. So in general, it's got cleaner emissions, it's very safe, and fleet owners are also seeing the economic benefits of it because they're able to reduce their fuel expenditures approximately 40%. And they also, in conjunction with that, have lower maintenance costs because their oil change intervals are extended. And compared to diesel, for example, they don't have some of the same maintenance issues that those diesel school buses are contending with today. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Mr. O'Gara, Ryan O'Gara. From SKB Environmental. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ryan O'Gara with SKB Environmental. SKB is a solid waste firm. We've been in Minnesota for 30 years operating landfills and recycling facilities. I'm here today with a very exciting project that we've been looking at for the past decade as the next generation of a waste processing facility. We partnered with a company from Canada called Enerkem. There's a handout coming around to you. Enerkem built the first facility of its kind in the world, partnering with the city of Edmonton. It's operating at a commercial scale, and it's operating today. The second facility in the world is being built in outside of Montreal, and we're working with them to bring the first facility of its kind to the United States in Invergrove Heights at our on our landfill property in Invergrove Heights. The facility would be $200 million entirely of private investment, would create over 100 direct jobs at the facility, in addition to hundreds of labor jobs during the construction. We have a project labor agreement in place with the trades, and would also generate roughly 100 to 150 indirect jobs from ancillary supporting businesses that would support the facility. We are not asking for any subsidy for the facility or for for the facility to compete. What we are asking for is on line 20 of the spreadsheet. It's $300,000 as a grant to Met Council for wastewater infrastructure. What we do need for the facility does use quite a bit of water, roughly 1.6 million gallons a day. Rather than seek fresh groundwater sources as the source of that industrial water for cooling water, we've been working very closely with the Met Council on using reclaimed wastewater from the Empire Treatment Plant, which currently discharges to the Mississippi River. We've been working with Met Council. It's technically feasible, and we're working with them to finalize a use agreement. We do need to secure some funding to ensure that we have money available for a segment of pipe on 117th Street in Invergrove Heights, so that we have that segment of pipe put in when the city is planning to do a major renovation on the street, including extending other utilities. And so it would make absolute sense to put that pipe in at that time. It'd be much one, in addition to being cheaper, it would also be very difficult for us to go in and tear up the road after it's already been torn up once to put this pipe in. And this funding would allow Met Council and the city of Invergrove Heights to do that. So I do want to assure the committee that not a dime of this money would go into SKB or Intercom's pocket. The pipe would be 100% publicly owned. In the interest of time, I'll end it there, but certainly willing to stick around for a little bit if there's any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next up, Mr. Phelps from the University of Minnesota. And I've got Gary Blatzik written down here. He must be a professor from the university.
Distinguished
professor. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Nick Phelps, director of the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center.
Good. I'm Gary Blatzik, Minnesota Conservation Federation. And when I signed up this morning, I didn't know that Director Phillips is going to testify, so I'll listen to his presentation and add just a couple words.
We'll call it a tag team.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Thank you.
First of all, Mr. Chairs, committee, I want to thank you very much for the recognition of the importance of invasive species research, albeit in different ways. I'm here to support the version that is in the Senate side, also supported by the state's AS Advisory Committee, the Minnesota Coalition of Lake Associations, a bunch of individual lake associations, such as Gulf Chain of Lakes, Pelican, Whitefish, Vermilion, Minnetonka, name a few. Nonprofit groups like Minnesota Lake and Rivers Advocates, Conservation Minnesota, I could go on. A lot of people find this to be a very important issue, and AIS to be a huge concern for the state. The state legislature here should be commended in 2012 for taking a leadership role in creating MACERC, the Research Center. That was set up with one-time funding, though, which currently ends in 2019. In the short lifespan we've had so far at the center, we've made a lot of progress, and I've testified to the Senate's Environment Committee and talked to many of you individually about the details of our work that's going on. But I'll sum it up by saying I believe very strongly that if we collectively remain determined to address these problems, we can win the fight. I could go on there, but what I want to address today specifically is the importance of stable, long-term funding. Minnesota has to have a place that can prioritize research needs, that can evaluate science that's being proposed, can coordinate and support internally and externally funded projects, a place that can see long-term efforts through to implementation, and provide an independent science-based perspective on the problems that we're facing. All of this is difficult or near impossible to fund through traditional grants and external sources. That's why it's important. That's why I'm here today making this plea to you. We could jump from grant to grant and go back to the way it was before MACERC was around, but that will ensure that the research remains, it goes back to being fragmented, that I, as a researcher, jump from issue to issue based on the hot topic of the day. There's a lot of reasons why that didn't make sense, and ultimately it's going to be less efficient and less effective. We have a lot of unknowns with AIS right now, and we've got a lot of questions to answer. Our work is definitely cut out for us. But if we don't attack this problem with the same aggressiveness that these species have in our waters, the problem's going to get worse, it's going to be more expensive to fix, and very likely may be irreversible.
Mr. Chairman, just to add, in your spreadsheet, Article 1, page R20, is where we're talking, top of the page, there's $400,000 in the Senate bill and zero in the House. So that's where the difference is. And I just want to echo what the director just said. AIS is threatens our fisheries, recreation, and lake-based economies of Minnesota. We all know that. We all experience the public access work that's done every year. This is the research we need. We, most of us know or have worked with Dr. Sorensen. He's appeared in this very room many times to get this jump started. Dr. Phillips and his PhD candidates continue to work not only on CARP but other AIS problems. And I had the privilege to serve on the advisory committee for, I believe, the first 2 years, and they kicked me off at the end of the year, but that's another story. But and Commissioner Landwehr chaired it for the first couple of years, just to show you the important guys that were there. So it's a very important issue. LCCMR started this with money. Lasard Sams continued it, and we need to get this into baseline. So we appreciate the problem putting budgets together, but please take a hard look at this and see if we can keep this research effort alive so we don't have silver carp trying to fly into our bathtubs here in the near future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the couple of words there, Mr. Bostick.
Thank you.
Next up, Elizabeth Waffle. Welcome. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Elizabeth Waffle, and I am here today on behalf of the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Organization, which is a member organization of more than 100 cities, counties, nonprofits, and individuals throughout Greater Minnesota. I think we have at least two or more members in each of your districts, except for Representative Uglums. So we've got a real strong presence throughout the state. We would like to thank you, the Senate for including a general fund appropriation of $500,000 each to two statewide grant programs that provide matching funds to counties, cities, and townships that have been around since the 1960s. This was taken from a bill that Senator Reid carried forward for us. These programs are extremely important statewide programs, and every single one of you has cities and counties and townships that have received grants from these programs, including Representative Uglums. Parks and trails are an extremely important part of who we are in Minnesota and are really built into the fabric of our daily lives. They're essential for helping Minnesotans stay healthy and active and also contribute to our local economies. Local parks and trails are really the foundation of our statewide system. They're the nearest, most accessible, and sometimes the only opportunity in some places for outdoor recreation. Now, legacy funds have been great boon for the state, but under the language of the Constitution, they're limited to only regional and statewide programs, which means that many of the important local projects that affect so many of us just aren't eligible for us, for these funds. So that's why we're really grateful to the Senate and for the help from Senator Reid and the rest of the folks over there for helping us on this, and would strongly encourage the committee to keep this appropriation in the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, Ms. Beatty. And I always mess up your name. I apologize. Friends of the Mississippi River, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lely Fadahi, and I represent Friends of the Mississippi River. Today I'm going to limit my testimony to two provisions found in either the House or Senate versions of the bill. First, FMR supports the inclusion of the Senate's language on R43-44, setting a goal of 25% reduction in water pollution by 2025. Yesterday, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 Minnesotans from all over the state came to the Capitol to show their support for protecting Minnesota's water and other natural resources. Some of you may have had the opportunity to meet with some constituents that were part of this group who may have directly expressed their support to you. If the legislature cannot come together to support even a goal of cleaner water for Minnesotans to drink, fish, and swim in, it will send a clear signal to these and millions of other Minnesotans that there's a fundamental disconnect in values and priorities between their elected officials and them. Second, FMR opposes the Senate language on R106, which suspends water quality standards that are scientifically and empirically demonstrated to be necessary for protecting our rivers and our streams from dangerous levels of phosphorus and related pollutants. Furthermore, this language would bring the state of Minnesota out of compliance with the requirements of the Clean Water Act by requiring it to suspend water quality standards that have been approved by the EPA. And so quite the opposite of creating regulatory certainty for local units of government, this provision would create substantial uncertainty for them in terms of obligations that may be imposed on them subsequently by EPA or legal liability that they may face. FMR agrees, but we will defer to the testimony you'll shortly hear from some of our colleagues from other environmental organizations who will express support for the Senate language on R90 to classify private data used for draft EIS, for draft environmental impact statements as public data, as well as opposing the House language on R85 through 86, which eliminates the coordinating authority for the EQB and turns it into yet another business first stop. And then finally, I want to express my disappointment that once again we find ourselves before a committee that has imposed limitations on the scope of public testimony such that major substantive issues are excluded from discussion. There are meaningful substantive differences between the House and Senate language that, for example, prohibits the MPCA and the DNR from using guidance and bulletins and interpretive statements to assist regulated industries with understanding and complying with environmental protections. So too are there meaningful policy differences in the sections on buffers, for example, in terms of allowing landowners to request approval for using alternative practices instead of buffers in order to meet statutory requirements. And I'm somewhat dismayed by the decision to disallow preclude public testimony on some of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Mr. Thiessen, Linden Hills Power and Light. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Forrest Thiessen, and I'm the Executive Director of Linden Hills Power and Light. Thank you for the opportunity to voice our opposition to the so-called Consumer Choice Act. Many of these points have already been voiced, but we want to respectfully and briefly reiterate this growing opposition. This act would strip local communities of their right to self-determination and impede them from using locally tailored solutions to best meet their unique needs. We all know that issues of waste management are different across our state. We need to allow autonomy for our communities to meet their varied needs for waste management. The Minneapolis policy reflects the unique metro needs for managing waste. It draws on insight from the many communities already using plastic bag bans with common sense and reasonable exceptions built in. Other communities, such as St. Louis Park, have investigated and decided that a ban is not right for them. This act would prohibit innovation and halt local solutions to the local problems associated with single-use bags. A narrow economic interest is working hard here to protect an old way of doing business. But many businesses have already come around. Retailers, from local co-ops to large chains such as Aldi and Target, have charged bag fees or even altogether moved away from plastic bags. Others offer incentives to use reusable bags. These businesses, alongside many local consumers, citizens, and municipalities, agree that plastic bags are uneconomical, wasteful, and detrimental to both local and global environments. The growing opposition to this bill has organized a petition with almost 600 signatures and a letter signed by 12 organizations across Minnesota, which has been presented to the governor's office. On behalf of this growing opposition, I ask you to remove this provision in the Senate version of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Jenny Puhl, Minnesota Grocers Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jeannie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Section 105. The Minnesota Grocers Association is the state trade association representing the retail food industry in Minnesota. We have over 300 members with nearly 1,200 locations statewide. Our members include grocers, convenience stores, wholesalers, manufacturers, and really anyone that supports the industry. We are responsible for about one out of every 20 jobs in this great state. The MGA and its members are incredibly proud of the communities we serve. Social and environmental responsibility is a priority for our members. The food industry is a dedicated leader in voluntary recycling and is dedicated to waste reduction. Local bag restrictions have the potential to interfere with positive efforts already underway, many of which you just heard of. They create unintended consequences. For years, we have voluntarily encouraged our shoppers to reduce, reuse, and recycle by offering plastic bag recycling and giving choice. Right at the door on your way out are convenient drop spots. Through these voluntary recycling efforts, millions of pounds of plastics are recycled annually. It should be noted that these recycled products are not just the bags from our stores, but they are all the plastic products used within your homes. Those toilet paper or bag recyclings, all of those come back to the store. This is an excellent community service that we provide, as curbside is not an option. Execution of bags, bans, and fees at checkout has many complicated layers, such as an additional cost to implement and execute, a slower checkout experience, governmental program restrictions, and taxation complications, all of which will change our customers' shopping experiences. Proposals such as these have a tendency to move us in the opposite direction and in some cases even regressive results. We want to be very clear that our number one concern as an industry is the patchwork that these ordinances have on our customers. It is of the utmost importance to the retail food industry of Minnesota that we have the ability to ensure that our customers have the convenience and the choices that they need and have come to expect during the shopping experience. As an incredibly mobile society, we know that consumers will make choices that fit their needs. Providing plastic, paper, or reusable at checkout is an expectation. For an industry that operates on the smallest margins, about 1 to 1.5%, frustrating our customers and giving them a reason to look for other shopping solutions just doesn't make sense. Reducing litter needs to be a commitment from those who litter. We support collaborative, voluntary educational opportunities that will drive our collective goals. We thank you for your inclusion and consideration of supporting this provision, and I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. And on your agenda, Ken Gordon from Minneapolis could not make it. Just a note. Next up would be Allison Wolf. Oh, you are? I'm sorry. I stand corrected. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daryl Gerber, and I am also with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and we'll be pinch hitting for Allison today.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As you can see, I have quite a few items to go through, so I'll just touch on them really quickly, but you did receive in your packet a longer written testimony that covers these issues. One of the things I'd mention on the budget section in Article 1 is really to point out the cuts to the Soil and Water Conservation District funding that is in there that was already brought up earlier, and we really see that as putting unnecessary pressure on the Clean Water Fund work with the legacy bill that Senator Reid is working on. On some of the policy items, on Senate Section 70, that we do support the new 25% by 2025 initiative to address the state's water quality issues. Mm-hmm. We see this as a very aggressive goal, but one that has the potential to really create energy and innovation in the water arena in Minnesota. Also on Senate Section 18, the deals with the public access to data used to create environmental impact statements. Both bills allow private parties to prepare their own draft EIS. We do not support either of these provisions. However, if the private parties are allowed to independently draft their own documents, we feel that the related information should also be publicly available, and so we do support the Senate language in that section. Related to the House sections 51 through 52, eliminating the public right to appeal in permit to mine, We cannot support either of the approaches. However, if we do encourage you to work with the House language and try to find a way to retain the right of Minnesota taxpayers to seek administrative review, note that this does create an interesting situation where by limiting the people who, from Minnesotans who can request a contested case to those with adjacent property, but yet allowing any federal government to request these cases, it allows Russia or China to actually request a contested case, but eliminates a significant chunk of Minnesotans. On Senate Section 90, on Senate Section 81 relating to calcareous fens, these are one of the rarest and most sensitive ecosystems in Minnesota, and groundwater is really their lifeblood. And so we see that the section in the Senate bill that requires the DNR to allow this lifeblood to be cut is going to lead to irreparable harm to these. Similarly, in the Senate Section 90, the requirement of a depreciation schedule and well interference is an unnecessary one-size-fits-all approach that will actually further harm those that have been impacted by well interferences. The Senate Section 68, dealing with the golden shiners, we also oppose that section as one or more species of juvenile invasive carp are almost indistinguishable to these golden shiners. And we see this as really opening the door of possible importation of these invasive Asian carp. So I will conclude my testimony with that and let you read the fuller document at your leisure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And last testifier we have is Kara Josephson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Cara Josephson, and I am here on behalf of the Sierra Club North Star Chapter, which is a grassroots volunteer-led organization with over 17,000 members throughout our entire state. Thank you for the opportunity to very briefly share our thoughts on some of the provisions up for consideration in House File 888 that we are allowed to testify on today. First provision we have concerns with are changes to contested case hearings for permits to mine, which can be found on pages R30 to R32 of the side-by-side and sections 51, 52 of the House bill. This section severely limits the opportunity for individual property owners to contest a permit to mine because it only allows property owners who are directly adjacent to a proposed mine to seek a contested case hearing. This is a very narrow standing that would take away the administrative appeal right for other impacted property owners, such as those who may be downstream from a proposed project, who would also be affected by a permit to mine decision. Another provision we have concerns with is the elimination of certain environmental quality board duties on pages R85, 86, and section 114 of the House bill. While we recognize that the House language represents improvement from the bill as introduced, we are still concerned with the number of duties that would be eliminated in this provision. The vast majority of the EQB's roles in protection of our air, land, and water are removed, and we believe this is a mistake. The last provision I'll mention today is the preemption of local regulation of plastic bags found on page R96, section 105 in the Senate bill. This language undermines local control and community input by preempting local government's ability to improve waste management and protect the health of their communities in ways that work for them. Lastly, we would like to voice our support for the water quality improvement goal of 25% by 2025, found on pages R43 to 44, section 70 of the Senate bill. Keeping our water clean and safe for drinking, swimming, fishing, etc., is an issue that many people care about. In fact, yesterday, hundreds of Minnesotans from all areas of the state, including many of your constituents, showed up at the Capitol in support of Water Action Day. As you work through the conference committee over the next week and make decisions that will shape the environmental policy for our state, we urge you to keep in mind that many Minnesotans, especially those not represented by special business interests, expect you to protect our water. We urge you to fully fund the agency's budget request so they can adequately carry that out. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Thank you very much. Members, this is the part of the committee today that we're going to open it up for questions. Senator Westrom, I know you had potentially another testifier. I don't know if you talked with him at all.
Mr. Chair, I just, first of all, the question, but maybe we could hear
more about the topic, the second line fishing and walleye stocking in Minnesota. If there's anybody here from the industry yet that I know there were some from ALEC, but they could come forward. I'd just like to talk more about walleyes and the situation we've got in Minnesota and walleye stamp. Are we making headway with this, or where are we at? If we could do that, I think it'd be helpful in insight.
Okay. I guess we could ask that question of the DNR to start with. Bob Meyer would step up real quick, and then we'll have the testifiers talk.
All come together?
Sure.
Craig Davids.
Efficiency.
Mr. Meyer, to you, the question Senator Westrom had is the walleye stamp and how that's working and how the two-line fishing additional dollars would help. I guess maybe that's kind of a general question.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources Assistant Commissioner, and we've been meeting recently with the walleye producers that we work with. There's a co-op that exists, and actually there was language that was passed in statute, probably 8-9 years ago maybe, that helped us establish that and work with the producers to provide fingerlings for us on a contractual basis. One of the challenges we face is the walleye stocking of fingerlings happens in the beginning, or the first quarter of the first fiscal year, and we're sitting here the last quarter of the second fiscal year. I can explain that a little bit easier. So walleye stocking of fingerlings, we get the fry, we raise the fingerlings, put them in the fall. Our budget cycles, as you know, run from July 1st to June 30th. Here at the second year of the biennium, we don't know what our budget's going to look like after July 1st, right? And we've talked about the pressures that we have in the Game and Fish Fund. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place with these folks, not having an answer for them to tell them how much we're going to be able to expend for walleye stocking this coming fall. Now, next year, hopefully we can come to a budget that supports all of our needs that we have out there. We'll know how much money we have come September in May, gapping those fiscal years. So that's a challenge we have. The funds that we have available for the walleye stocking, half of the revenue, all of the revenue, I believe, for the walleye stamp is used for, no, it's not all, it's part, maybe staff numbers, is it all of it, is used for walleye stocking, and that's roughly, I think, right now about $40,000-ish, I think, is in the account right now. The two-line proposal in the Senate would allow a person to purchase a two-line endorsement for $5, with half of that revenue being used for walleye stocking. Our concern with that is, A, we don't want it to be thought of as a panacea for the need to increase funding for the Game and Fish Fund, because it doesn't generate enough money. Actually, we have a hard time predicting what that's at. I think we're forecasting at about $350,000 or so that would be generated. A certain percentage of people may or may not buy that second line endorsement. So we recognize the concerns the producers have, and we're trying to work with them to help alleviate those concerns and also strengthen our public-private partnership. Some of the things that they've been talking about is how can we more effectively provide them fry, which they need, and the certain strains that they need to have for us to be able to stock in certain lakes. Genetics are very, very important for us to continue some kind of genetic strains without, if you want to call it, polluting those genetics in certain lakes. And Jim and Rob may be able to talk more specifically about that, since that's a challenge they deal with. But bottom line is, we have limited amount of funds right now for walleye stocking coming from the walleye stamp. There is probably an opportunity to do a more increased promotional opportunities. One of the challenges we face is the network we have of about 1,600 ELS vendors. A lot of them are, you know, high school kids working at a Holiday Station or a Fleet Farm or another store. They may or may not ask you when you go to buy your fishing license, do you want to buy a walleye stamp? I know that's happened to some people recently, and it's a challenge we face, just as when you buy your hunting license, making sure that they ask you for your HIP certification so you can get your small game license, giving you the data that the federal government needs. So we can do a better job at that. We're looking at ways to do that. But also, how do we make sure that we continue strengthening our work with them, providing them fry, looking for opportunities for water that they can produce these walleyes in rather than the water that we're looking for. And And we're looking at opportunities and hoping to get some of those back with these folks in the coming days.
So we'll take a little testimony from the two producers, I guess I can call them that, fish producers. If you would, and give us a little idea on how much you've contracted with the state or how much the state has contracted in over the past 5-6 years maybe.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Bozek. I'm one of the members of the co-op that stocks walleye fingerlings for the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota has individual management plans on every lake. And we've stocked roughly one-third of the walleye fingerlings that are stocked in Minnesota into the management plans. And without our efforts, the management plans would go unfilled. There wouldn't be the opportunity for families and, you know, Minnesotans to get out there and enjoy the outdoors. So we are a really good tool to help out with the management plan as far as providing efficient, quality walleye fingerlings for the state of Minnesota stocking program. We've been doing this now since the Accelerated Walleye Program of 2000. So it's been 17 years now we've been stocking walleyes for Minnesota waters through the DNR contract that we have. Roughly it's ran anywhere from 40,000 to 63,000 pounds. And with our efforts and your continued efforts with the line item on the second extra line, you know, being dedicated to walleye stocking, the walleye stamp, being dedicated to walleye stamp, you know, stocking, we feel that we could be a tool there that will be efficient for the state of Minnesota to help out with the stocking program.
Rob Jost, also representing the Minnesota Aquatic Farm Co-op. I agree with a lot of the things that Bob said. We need to create a private public partnership with the DNR to see that the lakes of Minnesota are stocked efficiently, fiscally responsibly, in the best way possible, and we feel that we produce a good product to go towards that effort, and we thank you for your consideration with the two line language, and also feel that some language having to do with the promotion of the walleye stamp would also be helpful. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Wester. Mr. Chair, just Mr. Joe Sterles, Mr. Meyer, or Bambi Noah, or one of you, is the walleye stamp proceeds stayed about the same, gone up, gone down? Did it used to be higher, or is that, what's kind of the history on that?
Well, originally, I believe it was passed in 2008 or 2009, and it was promoted at that time, and I believe the sales went up to maybe $140,000 consistently for the first 4 years, and then the language was changed at that point to go 100% of the proceeds to go towards the purchase of fish from the private sector. And since that time, the proceeds from the walleye stamp have dropped to around $80,000 a year for the last 3 or 4 years. I think it's projected now to be, currently with the current language, to be $90,000 a year for the next 4 years. And we feel that the investment made for the promotion of that stamp would go a long ways. I talk to people all the time that go buy their license, and I ask, well, did you buy the walleye stamp? And, well, what is that? I get told more often than not. So I think it would, promotion would go a long ways to helping raise more funds.
Thank you. Senator Wester?
No, Mr. Chair, I guess just, you know, walleye is just, I think, what everybody almost fishes for, and so I'm just concerned that we continue to keep emphasis on this and hope we can find good solutions as we work this bill to conclusion. So,
well, thank you for bringing it forward. And I know, as Mr. Meyer has stated, the point of sale is not doing real well right now. In fact, I'm one of them that just bought my license some time ago, and I always donate to it. And just for some thought, I was talking or whatever, just talking back and forth with the clerk, and walked out of there without buying my own. If there were a sign there or somebody to say, do you want to buy that and what it's for, I think we'd do much better if we could work on something with the DNR on it. Senator Rubin.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, well, I also just bought my fishing license because I'm hoping this weekend that the crappies will start biting up north. But and I never heard of a walleye stamp for a fishing license. So So there's that too. But one of the things I did want to ask Commissioner Meyer on is on the two lines. It doesn't seem like it would generate a whole lot of money. Is there any thought to what it would cost for CO enforcement? Because now when a CO looks at a boat, he can see that everybody has one line, and then if someone has two lines, does he now have to check that boat? And I'm just wondering if there's been any thought to the cost that the enforcement portion of the two lines would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rood, members, we haven't looked at the cost of enforcement. We're out on the water enforcing the laws anyway. I think it would make, if a person was fishing with two lines, we'd want to go there and make sure that they do have that endorsement if it were to pass. So you may hear that people feel like they're being stopped more often, perhaps. I get a lot of calls sometimes when we're doing our jobs out in the field. Some people think we're doing our jobs too efficiently, perhaps, but it would force us to do that, those types of things. We want to make sure that the person has an endorsement if they're fishing with two lines, obviously. The other thing that it will force us to do is look at the limits that we have right now. Currently, you know, many lakes within the state are a 6 walleye limit. We have a lot of special regulation lakes. It will increase the fishing opportunity. The language does exempt Lake Mille Lacs, so we're not concerned about that too much. But as you could imagine, on a lake such as Leech Lake, for example, or Lake of the Woods, bobber fishing with a leech under a slip bobber would be, you know, double your chances of catching fish. And what that does to the fish limits, I think it would force us to have a discussion sooner rather than later of a statewide walleye reduction in limits of 6 to perhaps 4 or something less. Because of in some waters, the six bag 4 day in a lot of waters, but and we're looking at that right now because of you have lakes that are 6 fish, you have lakes that are 4 fish. A person can say, well, I was fishing on Lake X where they had 6 and actually come from Lake Y where it was a 4 fish limit, things like that. So there's confusion out there right now with the walleye limit, the bag limit, and the daily limit. So our harvest levels are based upon a certain level of success. If we increase the tools that a person has on that success rate, we'll need to evaluate the harvest limit as well.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
I'd like to speak with you,
Mr. Chair.
There's a lot of real smart, conservation-minded people in this room, and I would ask how many of you have a fishing license and how many of you can show me one of these, because I do have one. Okay, and just a reminder, Mr. Chair, it's not too late. You can go into the local hardware store and you can still buy this walleye stamp, just so you know.
Yep.
Yes, you can. So,
And I'd also add that if you choose to buy just one line, you can come in at any time later and choose to buy the other line for another $5.
That could be.
And I believe that's true of the walleye stamp, Senator. You still have your chance.
I will. I'll pledge to you before I get home tonight. I'll actually have a walleye stamp.
So, Mr. Chair, so after the weekend, when everybody goes home now, when we have conference committee on Monday, and you show up here, I'm going to ask to see these little blue cards again. So, okay. I do have. I
don't think you can ask, but I think the conservation officer up here can ask. Mr. Chair, go ahead.
It's $5.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. We can use 2 for ice fishing. Would it mean then you could use 4 then for ice? Would that double as well or not?
No, I'm sorry, that's not in the bill. No.
But yeah, you can go ahead and try.
I wouldn't suggest that. I think that would be really tough on the limits. Frankly, I'd like to comment about the how tough it's going to be on the fish. You know, if you really, really want to look at the taking of wild game and fish, the electronics out there right now are unbelievable. And maybe we should be looking at restricting those. I know fishermen locally that can actually get right on a pile of walleyes, and they can catch their walleyes in no time with one line. Without that, they'd have to do like we had to do years ago, is actually troll around and find them and go back and forth. So I think there's a real case to be made. The electronics is tougher on our fish than the potential of two lines, one underneath a bobber. So,
Mr. Knopf and I remember when we had discussions when the underwater cameras were invented and what that was going to do to fishing, right? You can see the fish, but you can't make them bite, so that's...
But it is nice to be able to find the fish. There's no question about it. So we're getting a little astray here.
We are. And just to keep...
We're letting out a little too much line.
Yeah, we are. And I will say this from personal experience. I fished with former Chair McNamara. There are some people that can catch fish, and there are some people that don't.
The need to line, right?
So I do have a couple of concerns about the two-line proposal. You know, on Lake of the Woods where I fish, there's a lot of different fishing techniques that are used in the summertime when we're doing deep trolling and so forth. You get those little 12-inch saugers that won't bite, and you don't want to keep them. But the problem is they come up to the surface so fast, the air sac comes out of their mouth, and they become... You know, if you're not going to fillet it and count it in your limit, it's going to become food for a seagull or a pelican. And so I do have some concerns that about the two lines. There may need to be some further restrictions there. I'm not sure what that would be, but I'm not sure that too many of the people that I represent or that fish on Lake of the Woods want to see double the number of deep water trolling techniques that are used and taking out a valuable resource there. So. Unintended consequences.
Sure.
And Mr. Chairman, members, the best way, if you want to fish the two lines, is bring a kid fishing with you, right?
That's right.
Four tip-ups, bring your kids out there, bring 10 kids out there. But there's a way to fish with more lines than you
know. We do need to promote that, there's no question. So anything else from the fish growers at all? Any more testimony?
Well, just thank you for all your support on the walleye stamp and anything that deals with stocking more walleyes into Minnesota. We're 100% in favor of that. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And Mr. Meyer, if I could just real quickly, yesterday we were at a bonding committee, and the DNR was there reporting the governor's initiative to have a additional fisheries up on Lake Mille Lacs. Is that still in the mix, or where is that at?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's one of the items that we would like to see happen. It would create efficiencies and allow us to work with that water body specifically on hatching fingerlings, or the hatching fry and fingerlings, and raising them up there, working together in conjunction with our stakeholders. So I can provide the committee with a detailed update on that specific project. It's also interesting. What we wanted to do is have a joint co-located office and the hatchery together on the shores of Mille Lacs to have an increased presence there. Right now we're using rental space over in Garrison to increase our office presence, our staff fisheries presence up there, work with other stakeholders.
And if I might, in that information, you may want to add why you can't take walleyes from the Glenwood fishery hatchery and run them up to Mille Lacs. And I know there's a reason why. Just put that in there.
Mr. Chairman, we can do that. Thank you. And I will keep you appraised of our conversations and our progress working with the producers as well.
But to that point, Mr. Chair, is it possible to extract the eggs and so forth at Mille Lacs and then transport those to, say, Glenwood, and then bring those same fish back to Mille Lacs?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'll include that in our correspondence.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Members of the DNR? I'm glad you don't have any concerns of Mille Lacs. You just said that, so I'm just wondering what that's about. Members, any questions from any of the other testifiers before we end the committee? Any questions? No questions?
For Monday, keep an eye on your email, and we'll and the committee sites, and we'll try to keep you updated on what the status is for Monday.
With that, we stand adjourned.